Good evening. My name is Meg Stemmler, and I'm pleased to welcome you for an evening on Voltaire's Candide, a bibliographic laboratory. This evening was produced in collaboration with Alice Boone and Ben Virchbaugh. The mission of Live from the NYPL is to create cognitive theater. Tonight, New York-based theater collective, Group Theory, will give new life to this mission. Ben Virchbaugh is the co-founder of Group Theory with Jory Avganim. Ben is also co-creator with Alice Boom of Candide 2.0 Online and a digital producer for the NYPL's Strategic Planning Group. Alice Boone is the editor of Candide 2.0 Online and the curator of Candide at 250, Scandal and Success, which runs through April 25th, 2010 at the New York Public Library. Some Live from the NYPL programs ahead will feature Peter Carey, Patti Smith, Lena Herzog, and Christopher Hitchens. Sign up for our email list to receive updates and information about upcoming programs. After the conversation, we invite you to ask questions. Please come up to the standing mic that will be in front of the stage. We are so happy to welcome New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik to the library this evening to lead a discussion on all things Candide with author James Murrow, playwright Stanton Wood, and curator Alice Boone. Adam Gopnik has been writing for The New Yorker since 1986. In 2000, he began writing The New York Journal. Gopnik's work has been awarded 3 National Magazine Awards and the George Polk Awards for Magazine Reporting. Gopnik is the author of Paris to the Moon, The King in the Window, Through the Children's Gate, and Through the Children's Gate, A Home in New York. He's also the author of Angels and Ages, about the lives of Lincoln and Darwin. James Murrow's recent novels include The Last Witchfinder, an historical extravaganza about the birth of the Enlightenment, and The Philosopher's Apprentice, which NPR called an ingenious riff on Frankenstein. He's currently working on a period epic about the coming of the Darwinian worldview, tentatively titled Galapagos Regained. Stanton Wood is a playwright and narrative game designer. His plays include The Night at Nosferatu, which was nominated for a New York Innovative Theater Award, and Candide Americana, a modern adaptation produced by Rabbit Hole Ensemble. Now Ben and Alice would like to talk a little bit about Candide and the projects they've been working on.
Thank you, Meg. Alice is going to begin this. This is just a sort of a preamble. This whole event is sort of risen out of an exhibition, which is downstairs in the Walkenheim Gallery, and Alice is the curator of the exhibition, as was mentioned. And we're going to talk about that and how that segued into some web experiments, which in turn gave birth to this evening. So.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Meg, and thank you to the New York Public Library and to Adam, Jim, and Stanton for being our guests tonight, and thank you mostly to all of you. When I really started to think about how to put together an exhibit, because I'd never curated anything before, I decided to go around to all the exhibits in New York that were open at the time, and I went to the Jenny Holzer exhibition at the Whitney Museum, and it was a Friday night. And it was packed. It was packed with people reading, and they were reading shoulder to shoulder, getting as close to the work as they possibly could. I don't know if any of you know Jenny Holzer's work, but it's a set of truisms. That was what was on display that night. Some of them are going to look very familiar as we start to talk about Candide. So I started to look at that one. Being happy is more important than anything else. It's better to be naive than jaded. Dying and coming back gives you considerable perspective. Torture is barbaric. And that was one that then led into the other things that were on exhibit that night, which were a set of silkscreen documents from Abu Ghraib, where the main work that she had been doing with making people read differently was then put into a fairly serious moral stakes. So I started to think, as I was in the exhibit, about how I could make people in the New York Public Library read differently. And I had this idea that a single event could have more than one interpretation. And for Jenny Holzer, it's a truism. For this exhibit, it turned into something more like an inspiration. So here's the manuscript that we have on loan from the French National Library. So one reads handwriting. One reads gilt lettering that's on the Voltaire's briefcase that we have on loan from the Morgan Library. We read the book itself. This is the first edition from 1759, printed in Geneva. The 17 first editions of them that circulated in 1759. We read it in illustrations. This is the first illustrated edition of Candide by Moreau Lejeune. We read backwards and upside down. You can see that this is a satire. Well, it's a play on Candide called Fame and Fancy from Boston in 1826, in which they've taken the criticism of Catholicism and turned it into something even more intense. So we see justice printed backwards and upside down. Then it gets read forward into the future. This is from 1918, the eve of World War I, where the French introduction to this edition says that Candide is now in 1918, viewing the world as it's about to go to war. We read it in its sequel form. This is an illustration of one of the sequels to Candide. We read it in translation. We read it with commentary, illustration, and the text itself all in the same page, in musical form, in map form, in newspaper form, where the controversy gets spun over and over and over again. And this is Terry Southern's novel Candy, which I was lucky to find in the Berg collection, along with the rest of Terry Southern's papers, including his redacted FBI documents. That led me back to the Jenny Holzer exhibit, because all of the Abu Ghraib silk screens are heavily redacted because they're documents about torture. So I wanted to make people read redacted documents in the New York Public Library as well. And then we start to read it with other kinds of historical references crammed into it. So we have, I guess they're taking Leibniz out of the book here, out of the body. And then finally, we have Chris Ware's illustrations from the Penguin Classic edition that was released in 2006. It was the first of the Penguin Classics to get this sort of cartoon treatment on the cover. It's unfortunately not a whole graphic novel. I wish it were. But it gives some idea of what we can think about Candide doing as we read in other kinds of ways. So with that 2006 graphic novel in mind, we started to look toward the future.
Yes, and I might add that edition of Candide would be Chris Ware. Book jacket, is this on?
There we go. Is on sale from 192 Books in the hall. So, you know, the library has been doing digital extensions of its physical exhibitions for quite some time, since, you know, the mid-90s. And we've kind of approached them as, you know, online exhibitions, kind of online galleries containing little universes, little jewel boxes, where we have a lot of the materials on display, often materials we couldn't fit in the exhibit. The Walkenheim is a very small space. So for Candide, we did a number of things. One of them was kind of rooted in the traditional online exhibition approach, which is this website. I'm just going to quickly go through this, but just to give you an idea of how the library is rethinking how it engages with the public through the web. Beautiful, visually lush site that goes into a lot of the visual emanations from the book. We have the Rockwell Kent illustrations from the Modern Library. We have a video, Candide in 2 minutes, which uses the Rockwell Kents and kind of turns them into a kind of a flip book that digests the story and has kind of major plot points kind of projected. And also it serves as a repurposing of the exhibition brochure, interpretive material that Alice and others wrote, mainly Alice. And it's a way to extend that and pull people into the exhibition. But we kept returning to the fact that the web is really much more of a dynamic, conversational kind of ecosystem. And we wanted to start building things that were more of an event in themselves and were going to engage people over a span of time. And especially with Voltaire and Candide, we have a book that has, from its inception, kind of generated waves of commentary, waves of reaction, provocation, sequels, riffing, pirating. And so we came back to the bookness of Candide. Quick background check for me. Before coming to the library, I worked for a little indie think tank in Brooklyn called the Institute for the Future of the Book, where we were experimenting with reading and writing in the digital environment, really trying to hold on to certain humanistic values of, you know, books as the vehicles for deep, extended thinking, but really looking with open eyes toward how the web was changing discourse and changing the way we move ideas around. So we did some projects. I'm just going to give a quick snapshot. And This is a book that was published by a professor of the New School, Mackenzie Wark. It's a critical theory book on video games, very kind of edgy and techno-culture-y. As he was writing this, he wanted to kind of plug it into the web to get feedback from a community of readers, a lot of which were active in online communities. And we put up an entire edition of the manuscript online and in what we call the networked book, not an e-book that's sort of frozen in a little Kindle, but really a living web organism. He had written the book in numbered paragraphs, so we sort of arranged it in a card deck, card stack motif. And as you can see, and this was just a blog that we kind of hacked into a new form, on the right-hand side, there are comments from a community of readers and from the author himself responding. And this process of kind of this sort of furnace of commentary and debate actually ended up impacting the subsequent development of the manuscript. Some of these were excerpted and interspersed with his scholarly endnotes in the edition published by Harvard, eventually in print. And it was a really interesting kind of opening up a window to the process of writing, kind of mashing up book culture with web culture in an interesting way. And we realized also that putting the comments on the right recalled something very old that we've been doing for centuries, which is writing in books. Marginalia. It's a time-honored tradition, but it's usually been a private notation space for readers. And sometimes people would share their glosses, so there's always been a social impulse behind it. But, you know, usually comments were bound by ink onto paper into one copy. But we thought by rethinking the book, rethinking the page margin in kind of a web context, it becomes a public square. So you can have a text capturing all the conversation it's generating. So other examples, we have John Adams, notorious, famous margin annotator. And of course, people are often hearkening back to the Talmud when they're talking about the internet, which is core text nested in commentaries. So it's an interesting kind of new era we're entering where texts and their rings of commentary are really part of a whole. And so coming out of this background and experimenting with the form of books and how books are expanded on the web, we had also done this in other contexts where we put the Iraq Study Group report in and with Lapham's Quarterly and had people kind of trying to elucidate that. So we thought this was an interesting mode to maybe elucidate public documents. Obviously, it has educational implications where the classroom discussion can be taking place literally inside the text. And we put some short stories up and essentially students were writing their own critical edition. And so we brought these ideas to new kinds of online programming around an exhibition and built this networked edition, Candide 2.0, which I'll open up on the web right now and just quickly give you a sense. And the reason these guests were not chosen purely based on their general erudition, they were chosen also because they have participated directly in this project. James Morrow and Stanton Wood have been posting notes, annotations in the margins of this text, and Adam has been engaged in some email dialogues with our president, Paul Leclerc, about some of the themes in Candide, which we're publishing on a blog. So we've opened up some really kind of more conversational, ongoing windows into Candide, an ongoing conversation, which is really in the tradition of this book, that this book has been generating for centuries. And so you can see here in the text of chapter 3, for instance, you can open up, you can essentially unpack specific paragraphs, and there are its comments. And taking the final famous line of Candide, "Let us cultivate our garden," which we'll inevitably get into later in the discussion, we started to think of gardening as a metaphor for reading, as a metaphor for libraries, in fact. And so this became a really kind of wonderfully self-generating way of thinking about the future of the library, the future of reading. What kind of books are we going to house and host and present and offer to our public? And here, so we had commissioned these readers or gardeners to sow the seeds of commentary and then open it up to the public. So you know, here you see a really kind of interesting new direction for the book, rooted in old practices, close reading, and trying to situate those in the very distraction-heavy web. And what we found some very surprising things, that we actually read the book in a deeper way and sometimes in a more attentive way by putting this framework around it. So much more to discuss, but we'll let that crop up in the discussion. And so we have, in order to have the text kind of in our ears as we delve into the book and discussion, we have put together a sort of a whimsical little reading engine, which will bring some of the text to life, but in a kind of a darkened way so that we can really hear it. And with that, I think we will transition to the stage and then shift into our first reading.
Chapter 6, how they had a magnificent auto de fe to prevent earthquakes, and how Candide was flogged.
After the earthquake, which had destroyed 3/4 of Lisbon, the sages of that country could think of no more effective means of averting further destruction than to give the people a fine auto de fe. It having been decided by the University of Coimbra that the spectacle of a few individuals being ceremonially roasted over a slow fire was the infallible secret recipe for preventing the earth from quaking.
In a bit of casuistry worthy of Pangloss, the administrators of the Inquisition applied the bland Portuguese phrase auto da fé, act of the faith, to the public burning of heretics. Sad to say, Voltaire once again had his facts straight. On June 20, 1756, the city of Lisbon actually staged an auto da fe with an eye to canceling any divine plans for additional earthquakes. James Morrow, February 22, 2010, 12:39 p.m.
Consequently, they had rounded up a Biscayan who stood convicted of marrying his fellow godparent, and 2 Portuguese who were seen throwing away the bacon garnish while eating a chicken. After dinner, some men arrived with ropes and tied up Dr. Pangloss and his disciple Candide, the one for what he had said and the other for having listened with an air of approval. Both were led away to separate apartments of a remarkable coolness never troubled by the sun. 8 days later, each was dressed in a San Benito and crowned with a paper mitre.
The paper mitres are facsimiles of bishops' hats. A San Benito is the ornamented smock worn by a condemned Inquisition victim as he or she marched to the stake or gallows. Such garments were named after Saint Benedict, who introduced them.
Candide's mitre and San Benito were decorated with inverted flames and with devils who had neither tails nor claws, whereas Pangloss's devils had both tails and claws, and his flames were upright.
While the San Benito of a Jew or an alleged witch displayed a St. Andrew's cross front and back, ordinary heretics sported shifts decorated with devils and hellfire, the flames pointing downward in the case of those who'd repented.
Thus dressed, they walked in procession and listened to a most affecting sermon, followed by a delightful piece of plain chant monotony.
Candide was flogged in cadence to the singing. The Biscayan and the 2 Portuguese, who did not relish bacon, were burned to death. And Pangloss was hanged, although hanging was not the custom at an auto de fe. That same day, the earth quaked once more with a terrifying din.
Evidently, Candide's air of listening, quote, with an air of approval, was sufficiently innocuous that the tribunal decided to award him a penitence habit and spare him the noose, whereas Pangloss, who committed the crime of speaking his mind, is clothed as a full-fledged heretic.
Appalled, stupefied, distraught, covered in blood and shaking uncontrollably, Candide said to himself,
"If this is the best of all possible worlds, what must the others be like? I wouldn't have minded the flogging. I was already flogged by the Bulgars. But, oh, my dear Pangloss, greatest of philosophers, did I have to see you hanged, and for no reason I can understand? And my dear Anabaptist, the best of men, did you have to be drowned in the port? And Mademoiselle Cunegonde, the pearl of daughters, was it necessary for you to be disemboweled?"
He was turning away from the scene, scarcely able to stand, having been successively preached at, flogged, absolved, and blessed, when an old woman approached him and said, "Take heart, my son, and follow me."
To Today, it is impossible to read Voltaire's account of the Lisbon earthquake without thinking of the cataclysm that recently devastated the country of Haiti, leaving at least 200,000 dead and 1 million homeless. The January 12, 2010 disaster also occasioned theological speculation, with the American evangelist Pat Robertson ascribing it to a compact that the Haitian people's ancestors allegedly made with the devil. The renowned British biologist Richard Dawkins offered a different view. We know what caused the catastrophe in Haiti. It was the bumping and grinding of the Caribbean plate rubbing up against the North American plate, a force of nature, sin-free and indifferent to sin, unpremeditated, unmotivated, supremely unconcerned with human affairs or human misery. James Morrow.
Good evening and welcome. Stanton, James, Alice, thank you for being here. We have so much to talk about and so much that Candide brings to mind. Let's quickly just to do some basic work. Candide's published in 1759, coming out of the experience, in some ways, of the Lisbon earthquake in 1755?
Yes.
And the famous thing that's always said about Candide, of course, is that it's a satire of optimism, and particularly of philosophical optimism, the optimism of Leibniz and so on. But before we start talking about that and what it's really satirizing and what it has to say about earthquakes and entertainments, I did want to ask you, Alice, something. First of all, it's a mark of the almost limitless ignorance that I possess, if you would not know it from reading me, that I did not realize that Candide, that Terry Southern's Candide, is a variant of Candide. But of course it is.
But of course it is.
Right.
We have a lovely post by Niall Southern, Terry Southern's son, up on our website right now, in which he makes all sorts of connections between Voltaire and his father. Both books were written in Geneva. Both books written under pseudonyms for fear or perhaps delight in being censored. There's a lot of really interesting commonalities between 1960s America and what was going on in 1759.
Talk about that, if you would, just for a moment, Alice, because that's one part of the background, one of the things that this project represents, Voltaire 2.0, that you've been godmothering for these weeks, is that is an expansion of voices, an expansion of possibilities, an expansion of audiences. But Candide and Voltaire have been subject to censorship throughout their life. Can you tell us a bit about the reception of Candide and how it and where and why and for how long it was censored?
Well, it almost immediately it attracted the notoriety and the attention of the French police, so that they tried to get any copy that they could taken care of.
It was forbidden for sale in France.
Except that they found ways to sell it under the table. Booksellers found ways to sell it under the table, which then turned it into even more of a publishing phenomenon. If you couldn't get your hands on it, then you really, really wanted to get your hands on it. And it went through more than 17 that we know of, maybe more editions in its first year.
Printed where?
Printed all over Europe. Let's see, it had editions in Geneva, in France, Germany, Holland.
So it was being printed everywhere and coming into France and coming into...
It had multiple translations into English, German, Italian. However, it entered the French censor list in 1762, where it remained for more than 200 years. Paul Leclerc, the president of the public library, has a really lovely anecdote of wanting to read the book along with Stendhal's The Red and the Black and Madame Bovary, and having to write to his bishop when he was a young student to get to read it.
A young seminarian
at Holy Cross, I think.
Catholic. Well, one of the things, Stanton and James, that makes this an extraordinary literary classic, but more than a classic, a monument, is that it's the kind of the one thing of Voltaire, this dominating figure of the French 18th century, indeed of the European 18th century. Dr. Johnson once said that no writer in his lifetime ever had more fame than Voltaire, and that may be true even to this day. But it's the one thing that we still read. by, it's the one thing we still read by Voltaire, unless you're an 18th century specialist, really. And it continues to speak and to be adapted in so many ways. Tell us a bit about your first encounter with it, Stan.
Well, I was a senior in high school, and we'd read the usual stuff, Catcher in the Rye and all that, and some other
To Kill a Mockingbird,
To Kill a Mockingbird, yes, all that stuff. And you know, for me, I'd had a rough teenage years, and it was the first book I'd read, Catcher in the Rye included, that I really felt spoke to my experience, that I really felt like described reality in a meaningful way. You know, here was this guy who was being told that, who had been taught that this was the best of all possible worlds, that everything was for the best, and reality was constantly contradicting that, and that was certainly my experience. And so I had a profound connection to the book immediately, and the book's humor, and the hilarious tone of the book, you know, that the cheerful way in which people describe the most horrendous disasters. So that was kind of my first time.
James,
nobody ever forgets his or her first time with Candide. I was the tender age of 15, the Abington High School World Literature class, suburbs of Philadelphia. It was an amazing institution in its day, circa 1963. James Giordano, my most important teacher in my life, introduced us not only to Voltaire, but to the plays of Ibsen, Camus, Dostoevsky. We read Flaubert's Madame Bovary. An astonishing, astonishing syllabus. So here I am, this kid, 15 years old, I cracked a spine and encounter women who take monkeys as their lovers and someone's backside being hacked off to feed starving soldiers.
That's the old woman who just came in is missing a half of her rear end.
These randy friars and most of all, the Inquisition, which I'd heard nothing about. And, it's the great Enlightenment idea. What if... organized religion is an entirely human-made institution. What if it does not, in fact, enjoy divine origins? And that just blew me away. That was my inverse road to Damascus. And from that point on, sign me up. I'm with this program. I was a teenage deist.
It's interesting what you both say, because, of course, what appeals to you about it, since you never were literally burned or hanged alive, no. I hope, is that there's something about the irony, the horrible gaiety, the spirit of the book that continues to seduce us and always has. But it seems to me that there are at least two different kinds of things going on in the book. One, very famously, of course, is the parody, the satire of philosophical optimism, the idea that this is the best of all possible worlds. And Voltaire is out to demonstrate that it is not nearly the best of all possible worlds, or that if it is, what does that tell us about worlds and possibility? Defenders of philosophical optimism of the time, or at least students of it, Leibniz, tell us, well, they didn't really mean that it was the best world in the sense that everything was good in it. They meant instead, I'm sure this has come up many times in the 2.0, they meant instead that of all the possible worlds you could imagine that the Creator had made, this one was the best one.
Because, emphasis on the word possible.
Possible, exactly. That we could imagine other worlds that would have less suffering in them, but they would not be possible worlds for a creator to have made. That's one line in the book. And the other line in the book is, as you say, James, is straightforward, malicious, overwhelming, wonderful contempt and parody and satire of organized religion, of the cruelty and the intolerance of organized religion. Which of those two things, one would think that the first thing, that the attack on philosophical optimism would be dated, but that the assault on organized religion would be current. Is that true, do you think, or is there still something in the attack on optimism that
you know, one
moves
of the,
us.
The critiques that people make of the Enlightenment was that it was, in a sense, naive, that it mm-hmm. was too optimistic, that the myth of human progress was wildly, you know, exaggerated by the Enlightenment. And yet here's Voltaire making fun of pretty much that idea. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, it's, you know, what I think is so wonderful about this brainchild of yours, Alice, is, you know, that the Enlightenment, whatever you think of it, there's a, you know, we all know there's a critique of it out there, a pretty severe one. But whatever you think of it, it gets a conversation started, at least here in the West, an open-ended, eternal conversation that must never end. And, you know, that that's the great gift, I think. And I think that's why it endures. And, you know, everybody in this room can now join the conversation that Alice has convened, just as, you know, going back to 1759, Voltaire convened the conversation about Candide.
Well, it's one of the things, certainly, that we've learned, for instance, from reading Robert Darton in the last 30 or 40 years, is that the circumstances of the production of books and pamphlets in France around the time of the French Revolution was one of the causes, if not, or at least a catalyst of the revolution. And that so that the terms in which texts get spread is one of the ways mm-hmm. that texts change things. But I do want to come back, if I may, to the problem of optimism, because exactly as you say, James, one of the things that's startling about the book is that the critique of the Enlightenment, as you say, mm-hmm. is exactly that they thought that everything was perfectible. They thought mm-hmm. that we could remake government, we could remake science, we could remake man from the ground up and we would make him better. And that the consequence of that is not the perfect people we see before us, but is instead the terror and the gulag and Auschwitz and so on. But as you say, isn't it the case that this particular text, that this Enlightenment text by the ultimate Enlightenment author, exactly takes on that critique, offers that critique, and offers a kind of antidote to it?
Well, I'd certainly say that you know, even if it is a critique of the Enlightenment, one of the things he's saying, I think, is any you know, you must start with a catalog of the world's evils before you can move forward to the next step. And so there's he achieves multiple goals through the process of both critiquing and
cataloging.
And cataloging, yeah, I think. So, and I've completely forgotten what I was originally responding to.
I think if Voltaire were to come back today, he'd look around, notice the ashes of September 11th, the whole thing that's going on in the Catholic Church with priestly sexual misconduct, and he said, why didn't you listen to me? I told you this is where it was going.
Exactly, I was about to say, this is a point that I think is ever worth underlining, that the focus of the assault in the book is not philosophical optimism alone, it's religious intolerance, mm-hmm. and particularly religious fanaticism. Yeah. That again and again, memorably in the wonderful scene we just read, that's what fills him up, as you were just saying, James. His motto was, écraser l'enfant, crush the horror.
Yeah.
And by the horror he meant specifically, I think, and this is something that Paul Leclerc and I have discussed at times, there are people who believe he meant more generally kind of the horror of cruelty and evil, but it seems pretty clear that he meant the horror of organized religion, that that's the horror that he had in mind.
I think specifically the Catholic ecclesiastical order.
And political, you know, and political structures too, because he didn't just stop at the church. He also made fun of you know, a wide variety of man-made political structures. You know, the whole scene with all the kings and, you know, so I think it went beyond just the church. There was a kind of satire of all kinds of
repressive structures.
Exactly.
Yeah,
thank you.
He's an equal opportunity.
Yes, equal opportunity.
Yeah, I don't think he's been reincarnated as Richard Dawkins. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, deism is not synonymous with atheism. There's the famous anecdote of Voltaire and a friend going to a mountain peak to observe the dawn. And as the beautiful sunrise occurs, Voltaire falls to his knees and says, I believe in you, oh great and magnificent God. Now, as for Monsieur the Sun and Madame, his mother, that's another story.
No, I think that that's probably true. I mean, Dawkins, with all of his many virtues, is a kind of optimist, isn't he? He believes in sort of the Whig version of history, that things are getting better, we're learning more all the time, we have certain and secure knowledge, and that doesn't seem to be a view, does it, that Voltaire is very partial to in Candide.
No, he's. Paul Leclerc calls him a Millerist, which I really had not even heard before reading this book. You know, when I was reading the book, I didn't focus as much on the philosophical optimism. And then what changed my mind a little bit in rereading it was reading all of the sequels that were published in the 1760s.
Well, tell us about that.
They're truly odd, and there's a reason why. Most of them have not stayed in print. But one of the things that they demonstrate, there's Candide. Candide stays in the Orient in its sequel. He goes to Denmark. Pangloss.
What can go wrong in Denmark? I mean, that's sort of, you know.
You'd be surprised, apparently.
You know, exactly.
It's like Candide in Connecticut. You know, you feel, at least he'll be safe there.
Pangloss gets his own version of, he gets to tell his own version of Western philosophy. But the authors of these books are really taking very, very seriously the critiques of Leibniz and Rousseau. And so that was a perspective on the Enlightenment of really how much it mattered to people who were, you know, writing for a popular audience that was deeply invested in these debates. It made me believe Darton in a way that I hadn't read when I was just reading the sort of the book history of it. To actually read these completely bizarre half Oriental tale, half Denmark tale. I don't know what else you would call it.
So the allegorical conte, the allegorical fable, was the chief way that revolutionary ideas got argued out through Europe in the decades before the French Revolution.
It was certainly one of them. And it's lovely to see Pangloss and Martin go to the French Revolution in another sequel to Candide that's published in 1790, which I thought was delightful. Okay. You can really make these guys go anywhere and have them comment on anything, even outside of their initial philosophical context. Your question before about our critique of optimism, we have a historical version of optimism from the 18th century, but then we also have an optimism that has gained a more sort of an everyday use. And I wonder what the difference between reading Candide through that 18th century lens is and through its more contemporary uses.
Right.
I think that's an important distinction.
We have an Oprah meaning of optimism.
Exactly.
With a big O meaning being, you know, cheerful and believing that your mission will be fulfilled. But I wrote once, I thought that really the equivalent of the optimism that Voltaire is mocking is what you might call optimalism. It's the sort of thing, I said unkindly, that Tom Friedman writes about three times a week in various stages of ecstasy or despair. That is, that we have arrived at the perfect flat earth in which we know that the right system is liberal capitalism, and the world will either accept the optimal solution or it will resist it. And that's kind of the Panglossian view of our time.
Yeah, I think Voltaire had a genuine tragic sense. I mean, the ending of the novel is so beautiful and so bittersweet. And they go to the dervish's house outside of Constantinople. Here's someone whose life is functional, but it's so humble compared to the grand ideas that have been crushing people throughout the novel.
I want to come to that, but we do have two more wonderful readings that I want to, and I want to get to the next one. One of the things that's fascinating about Voltaire's life is his relationship with women and the ways in which he was and was not a kind of prescient feminist throughout that time. And there have been wonderful books about, one of my favorite books of all is Nancy Mitford's terrific Voltaire in Love, telling about his relationship with the Marquise and and their joint adventures, in which she, as a matter of fact, led him into Marquise du Châtelet into the sciences. And in Candide, we have a heroine who's actually quite articulate and has her own story to tell, Cunegonde. And here is her telling her story.
Chapter 8. Cunegonde's story. I was in my bed and sound asleep When it pleased heaven to send the Bulgars to our beautiful castle of Thundertentronckh, they cut the throats of my father and brother and chopped my mother to pieces. A huge Bulgar, over 6 feet tall, seeing that I had fainted at the sight of all of this, set about raping me. This brought me to my senses, and I recovered my wits. I screamed, I struggled, I bit, I scratched. I tried to tear out the eyes of that huge Bulgar, not realizing that what was happening, that what was taking place in my father's castle was the form on such occasions. The brute stabbed me in my left side where I still carry the scar.
Alas, I very much hope I shall see it, said Candide innocently.
You shall, said Cunegonde. But let us continue.
Pray continue, said Candide.
Incorporating this kind of ironic moment into the natural flow of the action was one of the challenges of adaptation. Every moment in the book seems to include an example of someone saying one thing while doing the opposite in a particularly delicious way. Stanton Wood, February 17th, 2010, 4:23 p.m.
She took up the thread of her story. A Bulgar captain came in and saw me weltering in blood. The soldier carried on regardless. The captain fell into a rage at the lack of respect shown to him by this brute and killed him while he was on top of me. Then he had my wounds dressed and took me to his quarters as a prisoner of war. I used to wash the few shirts he owned and cooked for him. He found me very attractive, I must say, and I will not deny that he was well built himself or that his skin was white and soft. Otherwise not much wit, and even less philosophy. You could soon tell that he had not been educated by Dr. Pangloss. After 3 months, having lost all his money and his taste for me, he sold me to a Jew named Don Issachar, who had trading connections in Holland and Portugal and was passionately fond of women. This Jew took a great liking to my person, but could not prevail over me. I resisted him more successfully than I had the Bulgar soldier. A person of honor may be raped once, but her virtue emerges all the stronger for it. In order to tame me, the Jew brought me to this country house, where you see me now.
Oh.
Hitherto, I had believed there was nothing in the world as beautiful as the castle of Thundertentronckh, but my eyes had been opened. The Grand Inquisitor noticed me one day at Mass. He ogled me throughout the service and then sent word that he had to speak to me on private business. I was taken to his palace. I informed him of my birth. He pointed out how far beneath my rank it was to be the chattel of an Israelite. A proposition was made on his behalf to Don Issachar that he should hand me over to the Eminence, the Inquisitor. Don Issachar, who is the court banker and a man of parts, preferred to do no such thing. The Inquisitor threatened him with an auto de fe. At last, my Jew, intimidated, agreed to a compromise, whereby the house and my person would belong to both of them in common. The Jew would have Mondays, Wednesdays, and the Sabbath. The Inquisitor would have the other days of the week. This arrangement has lasted for 6 months. It has not been without its quarrels, namely as to whether or not the night between Saturday and Sunday belongs to the old law or to the new. For my part, I have so far resisted them both, which I am sure is the reason they both love me still.
As a longtime reader of classical and neoclassical texts, I find Cunegonde's relation here fascinating. Her insistence that, quote, a modest woman may be ravished once, but her virtue is strengthened by it, unquote, flies in the face of literary representations of rape from antiquity through the 18th century. The classical standard, of course, is the chaste Lucretia, the Roman matron raped by Sextus Tarquinius, the corrupt son of the last king of Rome, who desired to violate Lucretia because of her reputation for virtue. Lucretia then committed suicide in order to preserve her modesty. Frequently, the raped woman is an insupportable anomaly, especially when women's sexual value is determined by their virginal or marital chastity. But Cunegonde insists that her virtue stems from her modesty, a personal rather than physical quality, a distinction that clearly separates the violation of herself from the violation of her body. This fairly unusual move has important consequences. It both allows Cunegonde to relate a story that would otherwise be non-narratable and enables her to live her life without the stigma of violation. That Cunegonde is raped and doesn't die undermines familiar narratives in which the modest, raped heroine perishes in order to maintain the fiction of bodily sexual virtue. Nicole Hereji, March 5th, 2010, at 8:20 a.m.
And we're back, as you say, on SportsCenter. Let's leap off that last remark. Do we run a risk sometimes? I don't want to pick on Nicole Hereji, especially anyone who can write that eloquently at 8:20 in the morning. I think this deserves all of our admiration. But surely there's an element of pure burlesque in the text we've just heard. It's not meant to be taken entirely seriously, and that Cunegonde is a bit like the... what's her name? Carol Cleveland in the Monty Python movies. That she's sort of a representation of sort of naive, wide-eyed femininity in the midst of this madness.
Well, and there's also the she's so cheerful, you know, about the you know it's you know the pleased God and delightful cat. You know, that's the first line is filled with positive, you know, elements.
She's still a good student of Pangloss, and she's determined to see her experience as positive no matter what happens.
Yes, this is the best of all possible worlds. And so it becomes a kind of, you know, it's not that it diminishes it, but as in so much of the book, no matter how horrible the narrative, no matter how horrible the story that I'm telling, I'm going to tell it in a cheerful, positive way. And it's just part of... You know, it's part of life. It's, you know, I don't even accept it as unusual. It's, you know, this is how it is. You know, rape is a part of wartime. That's, you know.
Right. Maybe when they went to Denmark, they met the little boy from Hans Christian Andersen's fable, who said, you know, I'll tell you, the emperors around here are all naked. You know, mm-hmm. and eventually, that's the view that Candide comes around to and finally tilts with his master. And even there's even a line, kind of a throwaway line, where Pangloss himself, we learn from Voltaire, no longer believes it. He continues to advocate for it.
For this, his system.
For his theodicy, but he doesn't believe it anymore.
Yeah.
He continues to spout it. He has this kind of Tourette syndrome of optimism. Best of all possible worlds. You know.
Yes, that's not unlike certain popular columnists, right? You were going to say something else.
You know, in hearing it read just now and in thinking about Bernstein's operetta version of it, where Glitter and Be Gay is Cunegonde's story, I was really struck by Nicole's comment about the non-narratable quality of Cunegonde's rape, and that perhaps satire is that way of making something non-narratable narratable, so that that there's some form in which that story can be turned into something other than what it used to be. That's the ultimate thing.
Realism
that
is always right. Realism is satire. That it's the actual experience of someone being related rather than the idealized experience of a Clarissa who gets raped and then has to commit suicide.
This is such an odd chapter. Mm-hmm. It's the chapter that I return to over and over again when I think about this book. We have so many editions of it open in the exhibit because the people who illustrate it have these sort of odd choices to make. You have a million different offensive things happening in this chapter. Which one do you focus on?
Yes.
And I think that the non-narratable quality that she's picked up on is it a non-illustrable quality at the same time, or does it actually guarantee that people do more and more and more things with it because they have so many difficulties resolving just one offensive part of it?
Right.
Does that make sense?
No, it's like the argument people make, whether you completely buy it or not, I'm not sure, that Fanny Hill, for instance, is a feminist work in that way.
Wow.
Because it enables a woman to relate her sexuality to something that's not shameful, mm-hmm. that's not inherently shameful, uh-huh. but that's something that's part of it.
Well, it's hilarious, too, that she basically tells it twice. You know, she tells the story and then she summarizes it again and again. You know,
and the thing. Voltaire and religion again comes in, and also Voltaire and the Jews. One of the things that those of us who admire Voltaire have a difficult time with often mm-hmm. is his attitude towards Judaism and his Judeophobia, really. Has that come up in the...
You know, it hasn't come up in any of the responses to the exhibit. However, it was a question that we returned to. We wanted to put that on display, and so this chapter is one of the ones that we have open so that we can see the ways in which illustrators have turned it into a caricature or have really glossed over it, pan-glossed over it.
new word.
You might say.
Kind of wish it wasn't there, but it is there in the text. And you know, I like to think if Voltaire were around today, he would say, oh, you know, anti-Semitism, I got that wrong. I didn't continue that conversation long enough. It's just another institution, too, and one I don't care for.
Well, I think the thing, the best you can say is and the, you know, we can then get into tall weeds of maybe pointless discriminations, but that it's that Voltaire in Candide, but also but elsewhere too, though he's violently against Judaism as a religion. He sees it as the source of everything he dislikes in Catholicism. Isn't really a an anti-Semite in the sense that he regards Jews as a race as cursed. Right. He regards the Jewish religion as the fount of what's wrong. This may seem like a distinction without a difference, but the worst thing he can say about Judaism is that it reminds him of the Jesuits.
I think that's Peter Gay's understanding, right. The great historian of the Enlightenment, that it was yet another way to get at the Catholic Church through the Torah.
Since the Jews were among the prime victims of the Inquisition, as Voltaire was well aware, it seems to us like an unfortunate lever to use to open that particular...
It does.
That particular box. Talk a little bit about adapting it. This is something both of you guys have been involved with, is rethinking Voltaire. Stanton?
Well, my version was a modern version where Candide began in Bosnia and then came to America as a refugee, and his tour was all through America. And my goal was really to find the kind of modern events that in the American in our recent American experience that were relevant to the story that made the story kind of come alive in a really the way it must have for an 18th century audience, because you know the Lisbon earthquake was not that long before the book was published, so you know the same what would we connect with in the same way. And sadly, it really wasn't that hard to find events, and in fact, some events hit the cutting room floor just simply because there were so many disastrous things that have happened in this country in the last 15 years. So that was.
So, what was your catalog of atrocities?
Well, I had, you know, I had because he came to New York. I had the Staten Island ferry accident, 9/11. Katrina, there were some, you know, there was...
You had this scene take place in Brooklyn. There was a racially motivated hanging. It's right after September 11th, and there's the anti-Arab, which is an interesting inversion of what we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some extraordinary rendition and, you know, some homegrown terrorism and a little bit of economic collapse. Action.
So you had the whole
Madoffian action.
Yeah, it was good time.
But yes, fine time. But, you know, the same kind of, you know, but the book also connects in a weird way to our own sort of American love it or leave it optimism that we've had up until, to some extent, up until 9/11, where we, you know, we had a kind of all things are proof that America is the greatest country in the world. And so, I think to some extent we've been examining that or thinking about that in ways that we haven't since maybe the 60s.
That's a fascinating observation. 9/11 is our Lisbon earthquake.
Indeed, yeah. I think that we underwent a sea change, and American exceptionalism is a much more difficult case to make after 9/11. My use of Voltaire is actually kind of a near use in The Last Witchfinder, my epic about the birth of the Enlightenment. It's mostly from the point of view of a woman who undertakes to bring down the parliamentary witchcraft statute of 1604, under which alleged witches were persecuted and hanged and burned. The final scenes dramatize the last witch trial in America, 1730, in Mount Holly, New Jersey, if you're to believe Benjamin Franklin's account. And my heroine deliberately masquerades as a witch so that the media coverage of the trial will expose the fallacy of the demonological argument about how the world works. And I was going to have Voltaire be her defense attorney, but I couldn't get it to work with his biography. So instead I used Montesquieu, who actually could have been on those shores in 1730, and specifically, as a lawyer, was often filing briefs against the conjuring statutes. And so even though Montesquieu and Voltaire couldn't stand each other, you can read Voltaire as Montesquieu as a kind of stand-in for Voltaire in those scenes.
But in your imagination, James, and in your understanding of it, in a sense, that's the core that Voltaire is fighting against, as indeed he did in life. That is, he was against the last blasphemy trials in France, where man was literally broken on the wheel for having spoken out for Protestantism in a Catholic home.
It
was the hold of violent superstition on the world that is the core Enlightenment enemy.
That was his mission. The Enlightenment has been accused of making a religion out of reason, of sort of the same fallacy of faith. And I don't buy that. You know, I think there's a big difference between rejecting somebody else's revelation in a way that you've thought through and having yet another revelation. And of course, the Enlightenment's other great gift besides reason is doubt or skepticism. And I think you have to put those together. And that's what, you know, that's why it's such a powerful critique of faith, you know, and of the deference to faith that I think remains the malaise of our planet.
Doubt about dogma is not itself a dogma.
Yeah, exactly. Well said. Yeah, you don't need angels to come down and say, you know, Adam, Gopnik, Ouija boards are malarkey. You know, you just have to think.
Although that would be fun.
And I invested all that money in the Ouija board, too. You were saying, Stan?
Well, I was just going to say the other legacy, I think, is this, the idea of hope, you know, which ends up in, as sometimes characterized, as the pursuit of happiness, but the idea that there is a better life is achievable somehow, that we're not doomed to a best world that by definition can never be improved.
I want to come back to that because, of course, it speaks to the end of the book and to what we should take away as what once was called the moral of the book. But before I do, we have another reading to offer. One of the things that makes Candide such a wonderful book is that it has, though it's a beautifully compressed piece of storytelling, it does have some side chapels and some byways, and one of them is a side chapel about taste, and particularly about literary taste, which a senator in Venice offers to Candide. And let's hear a little bit about what the senator thinks of opera, the classics, and John Milton.
Chapter 25. A visit to Signor Pococurante, a Venetian nobleman. Candide proceeded by gondola along the Brenta and duly came to the palace of the nobleman Pococurante. The master of the house, a man of 60 and very wealthy, received his curious visitor correctly, but with little enthusiasm.
First, two pretty and elegantly dressed girls served hot chocolate, which they stirred into a creamy froth. Candide could not refrain from praising them for their beauty, their graciousness, and their dexterity.
They are good creatures, it is true,
said Senator Pococurante.
I take them into my bed sometimes, for I am rather weary of the society ladies with their coquetries and their jealousies and their quarrels and their moods and their spite and their pride and their triviality. And I am tired of composing sonnets or having sonnets composed in their honor. But then, on the other hand, I also find myself getting fearfully bored of these two young girls.
Candide, walking in a long gallery after lunch, was astonished by the beauty of the paintings. pausing by the first two, he asked,
"Which master had painted them?"
"They are by Raphael,"
said the senator.
"I bought them out of vanity and very expensively some years ago. I am told they are the finest in Italy, but I don't in the least care for them. The coloring is too somber. The figures are not sufficiently rounded and lack depth. The draperies bear no resemblance to real material. In short, whatever anybody says, I do not find in them a true imitation of nature. I shall only like a picture when I can believe I am looking at nature itself, and there are no such pictures. I have a great many paintings, but I no longer look at any of them."
While they waited for dinner, Pococurante gave orders for a concerto to be performed.
Candide thought the music delightful.
"It's a sort of noise,"
said Pococurante,
"that whiles away the odd half hour, but if played for any longer, bores everyone, though no one dares to say so. Music nowadays is merely the art of executing what is difficult to play, and in the long run, what is merely difficult ceases to amuse. Perhaps I might prefer opera,"
he continued,
"had they not managed to turn it into a hybrid monstrosity which revolts me. Let them flock to their wretched tragedies set to music, where the story is merely the clumsy pretext for two or three ludicrous arias designed to show off some actress's vocal cords. Let them swoon with ecstasy if they want to at the spectacle of a castrato piping his way through the role of Caesar or Cato as he struts clumsily about the stage. For my part, I have long given up on these paltry spectacles that are the glory of Italy today and which cost its princes so much expense."
Candide disagreed with some of this, albeit circumspectly.
They sat down to a table and after an excellent dinner repaired to the library. Candide, seeing a magnificently bound copy of Homer, complimented the illustrious nobleman on his good taste.
"This book,"
he said,
"was once the delight of the great Pangloss, the finest philosopher in Germany."
"Well, it fails to delight me,"
said Pococurante coolly.
"At one time I was deluded into believing I took pleasure in reading it. But that endless recital of battles which are all the same, those gods who are always interfering but never do anything, that Helen of his who is the cause of the war but then plays scarcely any part of the action, and that Troy which they keep besieging without ever taking, it all used to make me weep with boredom. I used to ask scholars if reading Homer bored them as much as it bored me. The honest ones admitted that the book dropped from their hands every time, but said one had to have it in one's library as a monument of antiquity, like those rusty coins which cannot be put into circulation."
"Your Excellency would not say the same of Virgil, surely,"
said Candide.
"I admit,"
said Pococurante,
"that the second, fourth, and sixth books of the Aeneid are rather fine. But as for his pious Aeneas, and his solid Cloanthus, and faithful Achates, and little Ascanius, and that imbecile King Latinus, and bourgeois Amata, and insipid Lavinia, I cannot imagine anything more frigid and disagreeable. I prefer Tasso and those cock and bull tales of Ariosto. Fools admire everything in an esteemed author. I read for myself alone. I only like what I have use for."
Candide, who had been brought up never to judge anything for himself, was much astonished by everything he heard.
"Ah, here is a copy of Cicero,"
said Candide.
"Now I cannot believe that you ever tire of reading this great man."
"I never read him,"
replied the Venetian.
"What do I care whether he pleaded for Rabirius or for Cluentius? I have quite enough cases to judge as it is. I might have got along better with his philosophical works, but when I saw that he doubted everything, I concluded that I must know as much as he, and that I needed no one's help in order to be ignorant."
Candide, seeing an edition of Milton, asked him if he did not consider that author to be a great man.
"Who?"
said Pococurante.
"That barbarian who wrote an interminable commentary on the first chapter of Genesis in 10 books of crabbed verse? That crude imitator of the Greeks who distorts the creation story and, where Moses shows the eternal being producing the world through the word, has the Messiah pulling a large compass out of some celestial cupboard in order to take measurements for his work? You ask me to admire the man who ruined the hell and Satan of Tasso's invention? Who has Lucifer appear variously disguised as a toad or a pygmy and has him rehash the same arguments 100 times and shows him quibbling over points of theology? Who takes literally Ariosto's bit of comedy about the invention of firearms and has the devils firing off cannon in heaven?
Neither I nor any other Italian has ever taken pleasure in this sad extravaganza. The marriage of sin and death and the adders to which sin gives birth must nauseate any man of remotely delicate taste. And his long description of a hospital could only interest a gravedigger. This obscure, bizarre, and disgusting poem was spurned at birth. I am only judging it as it was judged in its own country by its contemporaries. Anyway, I say what I think, and I care little whether others think like me.
Candide was distressed by this speech, for he admired Homer and had some liking for Milton.
Alas, I rather fear this gentleman will have nothing but contempt for our German poets. But what a superior being, this Pococurante,
murmured Candide again.
What a genius! There's no pleasing him.
Alice, should we take those views as Voltaire's? It's a kind of catalog of every fashionable taste of the 18th century. Wait, it's as though somebody now were saying Proust is a horrible bore, Chekhov is a moral idiot, and Joyce is worthless. Are those Voltaire's views, or are they part of the satire, or are they spoken by the satirist?
I think that they're part of the satire. I think that they're part of the satire of what it means to be truly bored by anything that anyone else would take pleasure in. As I was listening to it now, I had a funny teaching moment. A few years ago, I was a TA for a Milton class, and one of the assignments that was given out was for the students to each annotate, in the spirit of what we were doing here, annotate 10 lines of Chapter 9 from Paradise Lost. And the students were actually really concerned about what to do. They were concerned about what to annotate. Were they going to get it right in annotating historical moments? Or I had one student who went through in a weirdly deconstructive way and annotated every single word of the 10 lines, whether or not could be, it could mean this, and it could mean this, and it could mean this. And it turned me into something like Pococurante in disliking Milton that way. But what it... What it seemed to reveal to me was the way that rereading can repay its own labor, but it can also produce its own effects. And it seems to me that one of the things that we're hearing in Pococurante's satire is that rereading actually has it can produce a sort of negativity that is reactionary rather than the love that we tend to think that it reveals.
Mm-hmm. But gentlemen, it's also a sense, surely, that there's a kind of bracing blasphemy that you can extend even to the classics, even to the most beloved figures of the arts. Homer, after all, is at the very top. And
nothing sacred, not a bad place to begin, I think. Perhaps Pococurante is supposed to be God. I'm just thinking of this now, that... I mean, if there is a God...
He thinks for himself, and he has very unsparing taste.
Yeah, he's bored with the whole thing. He's got everything that matters, and it doesn't matter.
Well, and I think Pococurante reviewed my first play. But there's and I always think of David Spade saying... Yeah, I like Paradise Lost better when it was called the first book of Genesis, And there's something kind of modern about his attitude of, this sort of jaded, internet style, nothing's good enough. I saw TMZ do a bit of it, and I'm over it. There's something kind of...
jaded about it.
Yeah, very much so, I think. Yes. And, I mean, that's part of the satire, but I also... weirdly enough, it seems very modern to me.
Yeah. Alice, you were going to say something?
It's a necessary part of the book if we're looking at how Candide has changed as a character. Actually, that's an open question. If he changes as a character, what he has learned by chapter 25, if it's better to be naive than jaded, which we saw earlier, I wonder what we're getting from this particular chapter, if it's just a side note or if it's some part of his education that
he should have the same skepticism about his artistic heroes that he has about his philosophical mentor.
I'm worried by that last line that we just heard. To dislike everything is what was it, Daniel?
Uh,
But what a superior being, this Poco Karate. What a genius. There is no pleasing
him. Right, that's coming through. But let's talk about that as we before we open it the evening to the audience. What does Candide learn, as you said, Alice? What's the, in the words of a blog, what's the takeaway here? What's it meant to be? Voltaire actually gives us a moral. He actually, unlike a modern writer, he's not afraid to supply us with a moral.
That's right.
He says, we have to call, il faut cultiver notre jardin. We must cultivate our garden. And as you'll remember, the very fine translator Burton Raphael in his recent translation about 5 years ago chose to translate that phrase as we must work our fields. We must work our fields. It's really one of the great and very bold variants in the translation of a well-known classic of contemporary translation. Because what he was arguing is that we can make, we must cultivate our garden too precious, too sort of petit Trianon. That is, that it's too much, it seems to say, oh, well, let's retreat into our own little world and make our roses grow, and that will be an adequate, if not a solution, or far from an antidote to the world of cruelty and superstition and fanaticism we've seen, at least it will be a retreat from it. And Raphael's idea was is that the sense of cultivate our garden in 1760 is not go back and work and trim your primroses like an English lady. It's instead get down there with your hands, get into the dirt. That's exactly the sort of thing that Voltaire's audience would have been alien as experience, that it's much closer to strap the plow on, work your fields, give up an overly cultivated life for the life of real things. How do you all read it?
Well, he nevertheless, it's not a difficult line to translate. You know, il faut cultiver notre jardin. You know? But that said, I mean, my take on it, I guess, would perhaps be yours, Alice. I think it's about writing. You know, I think that the gardener for Voltaire and the creator of verses is the same, partake of the same sensibility. I think of the great lines from Auden, you know, all over Europe. How does it go? The horrible nurses itching to boil their children. Only his verses could perhaps stop them. So that's the takeaway for me.
This is Auden's great poem from the late 30s, Voltaire at Ferney. Right?
Yeah.
Right. Yes, Stanton? Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, for me, it's, you know, I take away this. You know, the idea of I come back to the idea of hope, the idea of change is possible, and that that it's time to stop talking about the perfect world and try to create the perfect world. And the way to do that is to start working. You know, that's the there's no other way. You work and you focus, but there's something about the idea of this idea of hope being different from optimism and striving to not wishing for the best or believing that the world is already the best, but hoping for the best and hoping for a way to that hope. Hoping that change is possible, just like Obama says.
Has it been a line, a section that's been annotated and glossed and argued over?
It's been. We have. That's next week on the blog, and I hope
who
that.
Who gets to do that one?
Well, actually,
that's a juicy one.
I'm hoping to invite all of our annotators to comment on it because, you know, it's a line that's actually given me a huge amount of anxiety. In that I'm not sure that it has a meaning, and I'm not sure if I could actually ever access that as a reader. And so I'm sure this sounds very modern, but or postmodern, but I tried to put that anxiety into the exhibit in making it. In reading it as being about writing. I think that tends to be the way that I read books, books are about writing and they're about, you know, their bookiness. And so to see it annotated in so many ways in all the editions that I read, whether it's been translated in one way or another or turned into a musical,
I saw that sort of cultivation as a lovely metaphor that would actually get us somewhere different rather than maybe getting us back to the past of what Voltaire actually meant.
Well, I certainly think that for me that Voltaire clearly means it metaphorically. It's clear that he's saying cultivate your garden, and it is not the same thing as working nos champs. Yeah. It's not working our fields. But it's obviously also he doesn't mean literally, thank God, that you have to go out and raise flowers and so on. He means that anything you can do that's immediately at hand, any good work that's at your hand, that's not part of some larger scheme, that's not dependent on some form of unjustifiable belief, is good work to do. And that surely would extend to the work that people now do, that anything that we can actually have our hands on and control and make sense of is good. But let me open up the evening to all of you in the audience. We'd love to take some questions about this or any other aspect of Candide, Voltaire, the library, the work of someone up here. I'd ask you, as always, we're in a small room here, so I don't think we'll need a mic. Yes.
It's been such an amazing experiment in reading online, and I feel like I have learned how to be a better annotator as the weeks have gone on. Because at first, I really saw this as an opportunity for me to digress. I saw it as footnotes are the place where you put in all the stuff that you couldn't fit into your narrative. That's me talking as someone who's writing a dissertation that's full of footnotes right now. And then I did chapter 2. And then I read Stanton's comments on chapter 3 and Jim's comments on 4, 5, and 6. And I saw that they actually took their job as an annotator. It is a different role than I had. And that they saw their work as sort of explicating the text more in a teacher role. How do you teach someone how to read Candide? Whereas I had seen it as how do you digress about it? So those are two different ways of interacting with the text. And I think I've been really delighted with seeing those different ways of understanding one's role. And then when we've had people actually interact with the text who weren't commissioned readers, who were, let's say, friends of mine or people who came upon the site by accident, we've seen all sorts of different types of commentary. One of the things that we've seen is the way that the people get very anxious about actually having to come up with something to say, whether they're worried that their opinion isn't good enough about the book or that they don't have enough information about the book. That's one of the hindrances of maybe why we didn't have as many comments as we initially wanted, but it was also sort of an amazing lesson in what do we actually think we're doing when we read a book for someone else rather than just for our own private annotation.
Did you have to censor any of the comments? Were there any cranks show up?
Not that I saw. Okay. We got some spam, but I guess that's its own sort of odd form of crankery, automatic crankery.
Someone else. Well, let me ask you a question, Alice, and this is for all of us. As a enthusiast for this, for what's going on with this, of course, it seems to all of us as late, early 21st century optimists that this is the way that the library will grow, this is the way that our world will grow. Isn't there a risk with this kind of activity that we're getting the bells and whistles, but we're losing the boat? That is, that this isn't the experience of reading, as we all were talking about it earlier, where you're in a corner with a book in a solitary dialogue with a long-dead author, that though this has a wonderful air of community about it, it in a certain way removes you from the primary experience of reading.
Well, I was noting, I've noted before that I'm actually a speed reader. I sped read Candide, and I read it with Rasselas, and I read them both very quickly. And when I found that I had to sit down and actually think very hard about what I was going to say about each particular paragraph, I found myself reading in a way that I really had not read since I was maybe 6 years old, when I was, you know, speed reading Nancy Drew's just to sort of learn how to do it, because I really admired that quality in other people. So actually, and this seems paradoxical, having to read online and read for other people actually turned me into a very close, deep reader in a way that I had maybe hadn't really done in a long time. So, you know, it's one of those, it's a funny lesson about this particular experiment. I think that we have these tools that we think are going to generate some kind of thing, which maybe is a fragmented relationship with a book, that actually end up having sort of amazing, unexpected consequences, uses that we hadn't seen before.
Let me play John McLaughlin here. On a scale of 1 to 10, online, it's going to ruin books, it's going to save books. Go.
I'm all for it. I mean, there's no such thing as a writer who thinks he's being read too closely, it seems to me. I think it was Somerset Maugham said, you know, if a person would write perfectly, beautifully, he would write like Voltaire. And, you know, you've reintroduced the text to me, Alice, through this grand expérience. And so I want to thank you for that in public. So I give it a 9.
I'd give it a 9, too. Although I'm with you on the solitary book in the corner. But I also think this is a... Well, I'll just use the word, an awesome experience for rereading. You know, mm-hmm. that it's excellent. You know, once I've had that solitary experience, going back and having the communal experience, you know, reading more closely, seeing what other people said about it, having the text be illuminated in completely unexpected ways. I mean, I was, you know, my thing was I was disappointed a little bit with the chapter structure, because I would have loved to have seen people like following the old woman throughout, or, you know, discussing coincidences throughout, or, you know, a kind of longitudinal. I love the evil Candide posts because those were, you know, across the book. And so I think there's actually more potential to go in other directions.
I agree.
But I definitely wouldn't want to lose that sense of nurturing the really that sort of unique discovery process of reading a book on your own.
My other favorite Enlightenment figure, Montesquieu, of course, writes the book L'Esprit des Lois, the spirit of the laws. And I guess there's a danger of losing the spirit of the text of this great achievement, and focusing too much on the letter of it.
In a certain sense, you could almost say that in the Enlightenment, there are two different ways people learn to read. One is intimately, like all those mm-hmm. wonderful women and Fragonard portraits and so on. It's a way of escaping from society. And then they learn to read socially, too, as a way of entering society. And we're always stuck with that choice. Someone else here, please. Let's have some more debate, commentary. Lady here. Stand up, please. You can come to the microphone. Pocarotti?
We have a note on that, don't we?
Poco Carante?
Like care little or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Careless, sort of, or care.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a question. And a very good one, too. I know there's an old scholarly debate about how much you're supposed to take him as Voltaire's mouthpiece in the book, because it's true that Voltaire, who, as you all know, spent a lot of time in England and came to have a very high regard for English literature, also, as he got older, came to have a certain contempt for what he saw as the barbarism of Milton, mm-hmm. as he talks, and even of Shakespeare, who he doesn't go into here, perhaps because Shakespeare's reputation wasn't high enough in Enlightenment France. Someone else? Lady here, stand up, please.
I was thinking that the horror that he was referring to was equally
Did everyone hear? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
It's the mic for the audio.
Right, that's great.
In addition, what you mentioned about horror, and I was thinking, coming back and reading this again, so much of it was hitting me about war, and when he was talking, you know, and seeing that horror, and I think he was referring to that as much when he was talking of the horror.
Is that a broader, in a certain way, a more universal reading of it? That is to say, that his indignation isn't simply at the Roman Catholic Church or at absolutist France, but more broadly at the human capacity for violence and war, and that's where its endless adaptability resides.
That you brought that out in your version. Your version. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. That. Yeah. Absolutely. That he's. I think he captures elements of what it really. You know, one of the things that I love about the book is that it's so human. You know, that the behavior is just as relevant now as it was in the 18th century. And there's, you know, he does take on a broad, you know, not just church institutions, political institutions, but just attitudes and ways and behaviors that he also satirizes. And, I would grow inarticulate and say yes.
speaking of writing and reading as social acts, I'll tell you my favorite Voltaire joke. So Voltaire is in a coffee shop, the Procop or something in Paris. Young man comes up to him and says, "Monsieur Voltaire, you are the greatest poet, the greatest philosopher, the greatest dramatist of our age. I have written two poems. I want your honest reaction to my two poems. Would you please do this, Monsieur Voltaire?" He says, "All right, I'm now going to read you my first poem." So the young man reads the poem to Voltaire and says, "Please give me your honest reaction, Monsieur Voltaire, to my first poem." And Voltaire says, "I prefer the second one." "Je préfère le deuxième."
You know, my favorite line of Voltaire's, actually, which I have been trying to track to its source, and which we actually use as a motto in our family, is "once a philosopher, twice a pervert." About, you can apply it to anything in life, anything you do. Lady here.
Just one question. How come we don't have any writers that use irony or satire now? We get so little of it.
What the lady's asking here, if I may repeat your question, why do we have so little, so few writers who use irony and satire
in the
Swift,
you have little
of
nothing in our society for, I'd say, the past 100 years.
Well, there's Kurt Vonnegut, Joseph Heller.
Gore Vidal certainly sees himself in
yeah, I mean, the truism, I guess, yeah. Stanford, you've thought about this. You know, satire is what closes on Saturday night. But sometimes it gets resurrected on Sunday morning.
Well, Catch-22 entered the language. Yeah. You know, that was a good one.
I mean, I also wonder whether there are other sort of genres and even performance genres like stand-up comedy or, you know, that have taken over some of that function.
So the shock of irreverence. I remember, you know, when George Carlin came out after the Iraqi War, the first Iraqi War, and did his piece. I don't know if you remember it, about the one thing we're good at in America is bombing brown people, and it had a Voltairean shock of he can't possibly be saying that, maybe isn't that true?
So.
You don't get it in the writing. I think that all the writers who Jim was listing would certainly see themselves as being in that vineyard, if not making wine of quite that quality. But I do think it's also true that a lot of, you know, Voltaire is a great popular figure in his time, and one of the things that tends to happen is that role of blasphemy, which is in a sense a popular role, goes to the popular arts rather than the highfalutin arts, which we're condemned to practice.
You see it in Saturday Night Live instead of in traditional writing.
Exactly.
But I will defend the novel. It seems to me it remains a forum in which you can really wrestle an idea, a satiric conceit, to the ground. And so that's why I continue to labor in this obsolete medium.
One more question before we close for the evening. Someone else. Gentleman here.
The idea of the best of all possible worlds in the 20th century.
Could you start over again? You're saying the idea of the best of all possible worlds.
The very concept of the best of all possible worlds, the best of all possible worlds, in the 20th century is interpreted as an optimization. An optimization over a manifold. And in fact, in the 20th century, you have two major interpretations that are valid, as far as we know, equally valid, on this multiple world. There's a multiple world interpretation of quantum mechanics, which you have a branching off from every action. And then more recently, you have this idea of a multiverse. And so, in many ways, he was prefacing late 20th century philosophical physics.
Yes, the idea of possible worlds, far mm-hmm. from being an antique or defunct one, is, as this gentleman says, is very much an idea that's come alive again as a scientific idea. I must say, we were reading, there was a very good piece in Nature magazine about the overwhelming likelihood, according to contemporary physics, that there is another there are many other universes in which we are having conversations very much like this one, only with one of us different or standing on our heads to something. And as my mm-hmm. son pointed out when we read this piece, he said, and they put a tree frog on the cover of Nature that month.
Okay.
It is a contemporary idea. But is it the best of all possible worlds, or is it the best of all possible worlds?
That's great. I had never thought about that. That Voltaire is rather prescient when it comes to the multiple worlds interpretation of quantum physics. But presumably, all these worlds operate by natural laws, and one can imagine a world in which the optimization is a lot less painful than what occurs in our particular consensus reality.
Well, that's the core question, though, isn't it? We come back to again and again with Voltaire. Can we imagine a world in which... We can certainly imagine a world less painful than the one we know. Can we imagine a world that's both less painful and as potentially meaningful as the one we know? Or is the antidote to pain inevitably the anesthesia of nothingness, of not knowing, of not experiencing? Isn't that the core question at the heart of the book?
Well, and the question of free, you know, the question of, do you need free will to have a, you know, to, you know, if, you know, if we knew that the world worked according to, if we knew that virtue was absolutely rewarded and evil was absolutely punished, then we would, as one writer wrote, we would do good deeds like poodles performing tricks, because we would know absolutely that good equaled reward. And so I think it's also the question of does the best of all possible worlds require that we have this free will? Or
that's the whole Enlightenment project, it seems to me, is we say, no, it doesn't have to be this bad. It's just wrong for a child to die. Yes. And we're going to bring our reason to bear on that problem, whatever God's opinion of it might be, or whatever might be happening in alternative universes. And maybe that means we're going to give up a certain je ne sais quoi, a certain sense of tragedy, but I'm going to sign up for that. I'll take that bargain.
It can never be good, but it can always be better.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not the opposite. We don't live in a Lovecraftian world, you know, where it's nothing but the hole and the donut.
Yeah, I don't want to go there.
But, you know, the default, at least in the West, seems to be, we're going to try to fix it. You know, we don't necessarily know what we're doing, but we're in there doing our best.
Well, at least it's
chopping
improvable.
Our wood, as the last lyrics go, you know, building our house.
Well, with that, the subdued optimism of that annotation, let me thank our wonderful players who have read so well.
You can come out.
And let me add, if I may, a sentimental but heartfelt note of the many kinds of gardens that the Enlightenment gave us. There is none, I think, more beautiful than the public library. We tend to take for granted the notion that we have a place in which you can go and read any book you choose. Anyone can come in, anyone can walk in, and anyone can choose to read. That was, in many respects, all that Voltaire could possibly have dreamed of, growing up in a society in which that was impossible in every sense and in every measure. We take this garden for granted. We want to see this garden grow. We thank you, Alice, for helping it grow into a new century. And thank you, Jim. Thank you, Stanton, for joining me in being little weeds blowing about this magnificent garden. We're going to listen to the beautiful song, Make Your Garden Grow, Make Our Garden Grow, that comes from the end of Leonard Bernstein's wonderful operatic adaptation of Candide. And as you listen to it, I thank you all for coming.